Great. Well, then I think we can go ahead and proceed. The next case on our calendar today is A24-0592, State of Minnesota versus Michael Anthony Lee. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Hopefully you can see the clock on the grid view. We are recording the oral argument here today, so I'll ask that you introduce yourself and the party you're representing at the beginning of your argument. To anyone who's watching, I'll just remind you that no recordings of this oral argument are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. But as I mentioned, we are recording the argument, and that recording will be available on our website within approximately 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant, Michael Lee. Lee appeals his conviction for fourth-degree assault, contending that the district court erred when it imposed his sentence for the current fourth-degree assault offense consecutive to the prison time he served during the revocation of his conditional release on a prior fourth-degree assault offense. Lee seeks reversal and remand on two grounds. First, the district court's imposition of a consecutive sentence was not authorized by law. The term prior felony sentence, as used in Section 2F of the sentencing guidelines, refers only to a term of imprisonment and period of supervised release and does not include a term of conditional release. As applied here, Lee's prior fourth degree felony sentence was expired when the court imposed sentence and permissive consecutive sentencing was impermissible. Second, even if the consecutive sentence was authorized by the guidelines, the district court's imposition of a consecutive sentence here was an abuse of discretion. The court ordered a consecutive sentence to vindicate its own role in imposing punishment rather than based on a reasoned consideration of relevant, aggravating, and mitigating circumstances. I plan to focus this morning on the first question raised in this matter, which is whether the district court's consecutive sentence was authorized by the sentencing guidelines. As noted, it's Lee's position that that sentence is not permissible. In the absence of a departure, the guidelines authorize consecutive sentencing in limited circumstances, and I think the parties are in agreement on that. Parties are also in agreement that the relevant universe of limited circumstances we're starting with here is permissive consecutive sentencing under Section 2F2 of the guidelines. The only prerequisite to that type of sentencing that is further at dispute is whether Lee's prior felony sentence was expired or discharged so as to prohibit the imposition of a permissive consecutive sentence.
Ms. Graff,
yes.
Is your client's position that the only way that it would be legally authorized is if the sentencing guidelines explicitly included the conditional release as the definition its definition under of a sentence, which right now, as you point out in your brief, focuses on the 2/3 in prison, the 1/3 on supervised release? Or would it be in the definition of the permissive consecutive, or would it have to be both? In other words, under permissive, would it have to require include a definition, or in cases of conditional release, in other words, kind of build it in, would it have to be both? Or is that the only way, in other words, from your standpoint, that legally such a sentence could be legally authorized? And despite the case law that we both briefs talk about, where the Supreme Court's called it the functional equivalent of a supervised release.
Sure. And I think there's sort of two parts to your question, Your Honor. I think that last part, you know, the functional equivalent to supervised release doesn't mean the legal equivalent. And when the Guidelines Commission wants to identify supervised release and conditional release both as being relevant, it does so. We know that from the section regarding custody statuses. Supervised release and conditional release are identified separately there. Here in Section 2F, there is no reference to conditional release. It is not elsewhere defined in the definition section. It is not included in the current definition of an executed sentence. So I think to answer your first question, I think there are a couple of different ways that the guidelines could effectuate permissive consecutive sentencing with the inclusion of a conditional release period in play. And that may include a change to the definitional section. It may include a direct change to section 2F2, depending on how they wanted to achieve that. Mr. Lee's point here is that we don't have any of those mechanisms in place. If you look at section 2F, it addresses consecutive sentencing in two scenarios where there is an earlier executed felony and a subsequently executed felony. Those scenarios are during the first term of imprisonment, and then we aggregate the second term of imprisonment and the longer supervised release period controls, or in the second scenario, the first term of imprisonment is complete. We pause the second supervised release period for the second term of imprisonment, and then whichever remaining supervised release period is longer controls. If the guidelines had intended to include a mechanism for the consecutive sentencing of conditional release, it would have put it there. That's Lee's position. And so
well, I'd like to start with your plain language argument, and I'll just, I think that the biggest question for me is I think your argument asks us to interpret the language prior felony sentence to have the same meaning as executed sentence. And we have the normal canon of construction that, you know, differences in language should mean that we give those words different meaning. What's your, you know, response to the fact that, you know, if we adopted your client's interpretation, that we would essentially be saying those terms have the same?
So, and I think that it's important to clarify that there could be cases where the prior felony sentence isn't an executed sentence. So for purposes of our case, the type of prior felony sentence is an executed one. And in fact, an executed prior felony sentence is the only time where a conditional release period could be in play, because under our conditional release statutes across various crimes, the conditional release period is triggered by the commit to the commissioner. So there's sort of an additional step that would leave room for separation between those terms moving forward in terms of executed sentence and prior felony sentence in 2F2. But I think what's crucial here,
felony sentence would encompass also stayed sentences or stays of imposition. Okay.
Correct. And the definition section includes executed sentence or stayed sentence. So here we're just looking at what Mr. Lee's sentence was, which was an executed sentence. So, and then that, you know, I don't think this court would need to, in a plain meaning analysis, rely solely on those definition sections, although that's often where Minnesota courts start in the guidelines to say, is it defined in one, in sections in guideline one? But then looking just right at 2F itself and applying the whole statute canon, you have very clearly, you know, two component parts of a sentence that are addressed there in terms of consecutive sentencing. And again, that is only the term of imprisonment and it is only the period of supervised release.
In your view, is the phrase felony sentence ambiguous or unambiguous?
I think that reading 2F as a whole, under the whole statute canon, which is a pre-ambiguity canon, it is unambiguous and does not include a term of conditional release. I think if the court were to proceed to a post-ambiguity analysis, the same result should be reached. And we've talked about in our brief, you know, there's a couple grounds for that analysis on ambiguity. That includes prior versions of the guidelines, including section 2 that used to account explicitly for conditional release in presumptive consecutive sentencing. And at the same time, that was removed from the guideline. That was deleted, a specific reference to conditional release in the context of consecutive sentencing. They added the...
Wasn't that with regard to... where a consecutive sentence was required as opposed to permissive?
Yes, it was in the presumptive portion of 2F.
Not required, but presumptive, yes.
Yes. But the point here in terms of the interpretation question is that if we get to ambiguity, right, we're looking at the history of the provision and how has it evolved over time. And here we have the commission removing conditional release from the consecutive sentencing landscape and language in 2F, and at the same time adding in the mechanisms. I mean, there is no mechanism in the law or in the guidelines to achieve what the district court ordered here. You know, in fact, sort of practically speaking, right, the court orders him to serve his term of imprisonment consecutive to the prior revocation. But there's no statutory or guidelines mechanism to toll a conditional release period. It commenced when Mr. Lee was released from prison by law. And so we have this bizarre scenario where the practical effect of what the court ordered is he serves his term of imprisonment, the current sentence, both consecutive and concurrently to the same thing. And that's just unheard of in our law. And our position is that it's unheard of because it's not accounted for in the guidelines.
So is there any indication in the history of the guidelines as to why that conditional release language was removed from the presumptive section? I think it was in 2016. Maybe I have the year wrong, but.
I don't have any specific history from that, although when you look at the changes between the 2015 and 2016, it was a significant narrowing. They really scaled back the categories of what could get to a presumptively consecutive sentence. So, you know, I would say the shift between 2F in 2015 and the shift in to 2016 is there are fewer scenarios where consecutive sentencing is authorized, both because there are fewer scenarios where it's presumptive. And our position is that by using and creating a mechanism in the guidelines to sentence consecutively only with respect to terms of imprisonment and supervised release, that's also a limiting part of the language in the current guideline that governs.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Graff, I'm curious if you know, typically in the district court, of course, when there's a stayed sentence and the sentence is completed successfully, the judge signs an order discharging and restoring all rights. And I realize that perhaps doesn't apply in your client's situation given his civil commitment. But just generally speaking, when there's conditional release, I assume the commissioner does that when there's a prison sentence and a supervised release period successfully completed. When there's no conditional release, but do you know, is there a distinction of such an order from the commissioner when there is a conditional release period?
I don't believe there's any formal sort of discharge paperwork that's equivalent to what you might see in district court. Essentially, the commissioner, you know, administers the sentence and then sets a expiration date. They would track the supervised release date. They would track the conditional release date, which, depending on how the supervision goes, could be adjusted. And then once that date is reached, the sentence is terminated. There may be some documentation that comes from the commissioner to the offender or from the supervising agent to the offender, but I'm not aware of any particular
the only reason I ask is obviously a situation perhaps other than your client, if you get such a document indicating a discharge, then that would seem to be consistent with your argument that the previous sentence has been completed.
Right. And I think practically speaking, it's the way that we talk about felony sentences, even when they do include a term of conditional release under the broader principle. For example, if somebody receives if he had received a 15-month sentence, plus a 5-year term of conditional release, we don't discuss that sentence as a 75-month sentence and break it down as, you know, three parts. We talk about the sentence being the 15 months and the term of imprisonment and the period of supervised release. And then we talk about this additional unique characteristic of sentencing. And we think that's consistent with how we're reading the term prior felony sentence in 2F.
But you would agree that the conditional release is part of the sentence legally.
Yes, legally speaking.
So, and your argument is basically that the guidelines are making, even though the conditional release is part of the sentence, it's not part of the felony sentence as that term is used in the guidelines in 2F.
Correct. That is the exact distinction that we're drawing.
That's based on even, and so how do you reconcile that with the case law about the conditional release being part of the sentence?
Because those cases aren't dealing with this question, Your Honor. They're not interpreting the term prior felony sentence for purposes of Section 2F. And so the idea that it is part of the ultimate sentence imposed, still when courts use that language or acknowledge that general principle, right, they often refer to these two, the two component parts, supervised release, term of imprisonment, and then the conditional release, in relationship to each other rather than as part of one thing. And so when you look at Section 2F, it does the same thing. Again, if they intended to include a conditional release period in the prior felony sentence, they presumably would have created a mechanism, just like they did with respect to terms of imprisonment and supervised release, for consecutive sentencing when the offender is on only conditional release. They did not do so. And so just because there are broader legal principles that included in the sentence doesn't mean that the Guidelines Commission has included it in terms of its provisions on permissive consecutive sentencing.
Okay, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the state, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Jeffrey Boucher and I represent the respondent in this case. Where all other requirements are present, a current felony sentence is eligible for permissive consecutive sentencing to a prior felony offense where the prior felony sentence has not expired or been discharged. A prior felony sentence has not expired or been discharged where, as in this case, the current felony offense is committed after the term of imprisonment and after a term of supervised release, but while the person committing the new offense is on statutorily mandated conditional release. This is because conditional release is different and distinct from supervised release and has certain following characteristics. Conditional release periods are mandatory and are a creation of statute. Conditional release periods as outlined in Humes are not waivable. Conditional release terms are part of a sentence as stated previously in Brown, and conditional release terms create an additional period of supervision beyond the minimum term of imprisonment for certain enumerated offenses. During this period of conditional release, this period of supervision beyond the minimum term of imprisonment, a person remains subject to reincarceration for a violation of the terms of that conditional release. The state's argument in this case is that where a person remains subject to further incarceration for a prior offense, that prior offense has not expired or been discharged.
Counsel, is the term felony sentence as used in the sentencing guidelines in Section 2F, is that ambiguous or unambiguous?
Your Honor, it's the state's position in this case, as asked previously, that felony sentence as applied in Section 2F is ambiguous. And my side of that argument is that as it relates specifically to the definitional sections, had 2F wanted to, or had the commission in its use of 2F wanted to use the specific definitional sections above previously, it could have used that language instead. Within Section 2F, what the guidelines added was language that is present in only two places in the guidelines, and that is this expired or been discharged language. It is the state's position that a sentence is ambiguous for purposes of whether it has expired or been discharged, as analyzed in subsection two, in Section 2F.
You don't disagree that there certainly are places in the guidelines where the commission specifically calls out conditional release as something different than other portions of the sentence, correct? I mean, that's where,
yes.
I mean, and that's part of what makes this complicated in terms of it. And maybe that's why you're conceding the statute isn't plain from your perspective, because of the fact that there certainly are places in the guidelines themselves that separate out conditional release.
Right. And, so my, and I apologize.
I was going to say, so I mean, I guess my question for you is, why isn't that an indication that the language is plain, as the appellant argues, that when the Guidelines Commission specifically wants to be talking about conditional release, that's a specific term of art that's used in that portion of the guideline?
So I think that while there are certainly portions of the guidelines that do outline specifically the application of conditional release, there are also portions of the guidelines, and I think this is responsive to the court's questions, there are portions of the guidelines that that directly refer to the term of imprisonment, the minimum term of imprisonment, or the term of supervised release. And the state's contention and review of this is that the use is that where the term expired or prior sentence expired or been discharged had been was used, if what the guidelines was intended at that part was a referral to a minimum term of imprisonment or one of the previously defined terms from the definitional section, that they could have put that section in there. So I think it cuts both ways. Certainly, it would be clearer if it stated explicitly conditional release, but I think it would be potentially unambiguous to appellant's position if that section referred specifically and used the definitional language, which it doesn't. It uses the term expired or been discharged language that is present only in that, only specifically in that section and in the section later, which analyzes the 15-year decay period, also uses the expired or been discharged language. And this court previously has interpreted that expired or been discharged language, though, in a non-precedential case, to include to exclude from the 15-year felony decay period the period of conditional release. So in the one other section that this court has analyzed, the specific language used in subsection 2F related to permissive consecutive sentences, that being in the analysis, the felony decay factor, the court has previously, relying upon the case law, which emphasizes repeatedly that a conditional release term is mandatory, non-waivable, and is a portion of the sentence, the court engaged in the chain of logic that I think that was plain and reasonable, that if a conditional release period is mandatory, non-waivable, and is part of a sentence, that a sentence is not discharged until that conditional release period is complete. So the state's contention here is that logic, which was previously applied, though, in the Bissell case and in a non-precedential case, did analyze the prior case law involving what a conditional release period is, that this court could apply and should apply that same logic to the permissive consecutive sentencing subsection that includes the only other reference to the expiration or discharge language specifically included.
Mr. Boucher, Mr. Boucher, how does that, your argument square though with the definition of an executed sentence, which, as you point out, when there isn't a conditional release, of course, it's mandatory, and yet the Guidelines Commission has not added that as part of the definition of an executed sentence? In other words, I assume what they could have done is just tag that on, or in cases of conditional release, whichever is later type of language.
So I think that That would certainly make the question simpler if it were included. It's not the guidelines. The guidelines language is sort of we're left with the guidelines language that were in effect at the time here. And
well, let me just to follow up then, assuming, because your point being it's ambiguous, and yet we also deal with the principle when we're dealing with criminal sentencing and defendants that typically an ambiguity is favors a defendant if it's dealing with a longer incarceration period, which a consecutive sentence would be. So I'm trying to better understand how you can clearly steer us to resolve the ambiguity in favor of the state's case when those definitional red flags seem to still exist.
My position on this, Your Honor, is that the definitional ambiguity is sufficient to get the court to the canons of statutory interpretation in this case, in which the court would analyze the entire statute and analyze based on its prior interpretation in a fashion that harmonizes one like section with another like section and harmonizes the sentencing guidelines in total. I think while there is ambiguity within the definitional section, it's sufficient to get to.
I don't understand how looking at the guidelines as a whole helps your ambiguity argument, given the fact that there are several portions of the guidelines where conditional release is called out as a separate thing and discussed separately. I think that once you're looking at the entire guidelines, you're seeing that the commission knows how to say when something applies to conditional release and when it doesn't, and that they tend to call it out separately. And so I guess from my perspective, I think probably, you know, some of your stronger arguments with respect to ambiguity relate to the case law and how courts have construed conditional release in the past. And my sort of broader question for you is, how is that case law illustrative of legislative intent as opposed to, you know, courts applying constitutional principles and determining when the constitutional protections regarding sentences come into play, as opposed to actually illustrating some kind of legislative intent that conditional release is included in the term felony sentence?
I think the application in a particular offense of a conditional release period, conditional release periods are limited to only certain offenses that the legislature has deemed significant enough to require that additional mandatory extra term of supervision.
And to be clear, for some people that's lifetime. And I get that factually that's not what's happening in this case, but for a lot of people, we're talking about conditional release being their entire life, which means as soon as you have a conditional release period that under the state's proposed reading of the guideline, you can always have a consecutive sentence, and that conviction would never decay for the purposes of the guidelines. So, I mean, part of what's assumed within the argument of the state is essentially asking us to adopt a reading that a person with lifetime conditional release will always be subject to these particular provisions of the guidelines, right?
As it relates to the court, if the court were to adopt the prior non-precedential conditional release analysis related to criminal history decay, I think, yes, that under that analysis, criminal history for a person who has a lifetime conditional release would never decay.
They could always get a consecutive sentence.
Could always get a consecutive sentence, yes, but as the court just stated, that would be permissive. And so it would be a case where the court would both have discretion under the facts as appropriate for the case, but then also would have only limited discretion in that the other requirements for imposition of a permissive consecutive sentence would need to be met. And obviously not every subsequent sentence for a person who is on lifetime conditional release would be on the list of permissive consecutive sentencing.
And then I have one more question with for, oh, can I ask one question about the Bissell case? And that's, do you disagree with appellant's characterization of that case that it didn't actually resolve the meaning of the term felony sentence, that it was resolving sort of a different statutory interpretation argument?
I think that the state's reliance here on Bissell is that it was the court's, the court's prior analysis of it, it was the only or most apposite case law that I could find, though non-precedential, where the court was analyzing two things that are, I think, critical to the analysis in this case. First, the expired or been discharged language in the other section where that was most relevant, and the analysis of expired or been discharged language and its impact where a person has is on conditional release, but the prior felony term of imprisonment and the supervised release period has expired. So I think both the, I think Bissell's logic as it applies to the, it is applicable one-to-one to the situation before the court today.
Any further questions? I was going to ask about Bissell too, so we covered that. Would you like to conclude briefly, Mr. Butcher?
Finally, Your Honor, I would just, I would ask the court to adopt the logic of Bissell to find that in this case, it was both permissible as the prior sentence did not expire or was not discharged due to the fact that Mr. Lee remained subject to reincarceration, and ask to find that the guidelines allow permissible consecutive sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. And I think I'll jump in on Bissell since that's where we left off. A couple things that distinguish that case. One is that Bissell was dealing with the provision on felony decay and not Section 2F. And Section 2F is uniquely situated here in terms of the interpretive question because it has the language in it that talks only about terms of imprisonment and periods of supervised release. So the interpretation in Bissell, to the extent it was conducted, doesn't address the provision at issue here. I also think it's important to note that in interpreting the guidelines, the Supreme Court continues to clarify that we do this like we do statutory interpretation. In Bissell, the court sort of jumps to extrinsic sources, which is, you know, case law addressing those questions that Judge Larson brought up, which is the constitutionality of sentences and plea bargaining and all of those things that are implicated when we have a sentence or not a sentence. And it doesn't actually look at the guidelines, doesn't look at the definitional sections. And so I think for those reasons, it is not only not on point in terms of the guidelines provision at issue here, but not persuasive in terms of the way in which the guidelines are interpreted there.
I have sort of the flip side question for you though, which is, you know, I'm struggling in the context of the guidelines to figure out what is, to the extent that we agree with the state that the term is ambiguous, what is sort of the best evidence that the legislature through the Guidelines Commission is not intending sentence to sort of incorporate the constitutional idea of sentence as opposed to the reading that that you're positing with regard to the guidelines? What do you think is the best sort of evidence that that's what the legislature through the commission is intending?
I think that the best evidence of that in this particular setting where we're dealing with Section 2F is the removal of conditional release as a status that triggers presumptive consecutive sentencing. So we're deleting conditional release, a specific reference to conditional release in Section 2F, and at the same time specifying what are the mechanics for consecutive sentencing and doing so only with respect to a term of imprisonment and a period of supervised release. That happens at the same time. And respondent said, you know, if they wanted to use the terms conditional release and supervised release, they could have. Lee's position is they did. If you read 2F, that is exactly how 2F starts. It says, here is how we do consecutive sentencing in Minnesota under this provision. These are the steps. And I would point the court to State versus Hahn, which is a court of appeals case from 2011 dealing with a prior version of the guidelines where the permissive consecutive list didn't include federal equivalent sentences. And the court says, well, yeah, there's basis for, you know, looking at equivalent non-Minnesota offenses elsewhere in the guidelines, but they're not here. And we're not going to read that into the guidelines. Similarly, we don't have a reference to conditional release in section 2F. And it, you know, it, our position is without that language, this court would have to read into the guidelines some mechanism to consecutively sentence when somebody is solely on conditional release. And I think, you know, respondent has talked a lot about the language expired or been discharged. And I want to emphasize that Lee's claim is not about that language. Lee's claim is about the sort of the antecedent question, which is what is the prior felony sentence? And only after answering that question, which we think under an ambiguity or plain meaning analysis, the felony sentence does not include the term of conditional release. And once that question is answered, it's very clear that the sentence was expired or discharged at the time relevant here. And we would ask the court to reverse and remand for resentencing.
Ms. Graff, go ahead, Jessica.
I'm sure there, you know, Mr. Butcher would argue there's policy reasons to support his position, but what are the policy reasons that would support the legislature and the commission adopt, you know, taking the approach that you are suggesting?
Sure.
That we should read the guidelines in the manner that you're suggesting. What would drive the commission to take that approach from a policy perspective?
Certainly. And I see that my time is up, but I'll answer with the court's permission. I think, you know, a couple of things. One is the idea that consecutive sentencing is designed to be an exception to the rule in most cases and is designed to be limited. So those changes in 2015 to 2016 limit the scope of consecutive sentencing. And it's our position that the interpretation we've put forth is consistent with that limited use. Minnesota broadly favors concurrent sentencing. And in addition, I think an issue that Judge Larson raised is if we interpret prior felony sentence, we sort of create, in the way respondent suggests, then it creates this sort of super class of consecutive sentencing where there are people on conditional release for very long periods of time, including up to lifetime, that then are sort of always exposed to a sanction that is designed to be unique. And we would say that those support our position.
Thank you. Judge Sleater, did you have another question?
Thank you. Ms. Graff, do I understand you to say, and this was part of your answer, I think, to Judge Cochran's question, but also Judge Larson's earlier one, that when we look at the case law, Bissell et al., as in different factual scenarios, and then we look at the definitional provisions within the guidelines, both the definition and then the language in 2F, is your point that if we were to adopt your client's position, we aren't inconsistent with Bissell in the sense that we aren't in the same factual scenario? So you don't disagree, of course, that a conditional release is mandatory. It's part of a felony executed sentence. But your point being, if I understand correctly, for purposes specifically of interpreting the guidelines of permissive consecutive, it provides the definition and it does not include conditional release.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And this court could issue a very narrow decision that would be not disturb anything in Bissell, although it's non-precedential, but that would be able to be reconciled with Bissell for that reason, because of the narrowness of the issue here.
And would you recommend it be precedential?
I think that it would be helpful to district courts, as it, you know, there was some significant litigation in this case surrounding this question. And I think it would clarify for litigants moving forward what the rules are on this front.
Thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Doesn't that put, I guess, the court in a bit of a strange position, going back to sort of the canon that when the same words are used in different portions of the guidelines, that they would carry the same meaning? Isn't that somewhat in tension with your argument regarding Bissell?
Well, I think there's a way to reconcile them. And I think, if I were arguing Bissell, I would argue for the same reading of prior felony sentence here. I think you could distinguish them, however, to say when you start with the analysis and you're looking at each guideline as a whole, so 2F, or I think in Bissell it's 2B, that they have different language in them. And so the guidelines can use different language within a particular guideline to accomplish a different result. And so I think they're separate interpretive questions, and only the question about 2F is raised in this case.
Any further questions? All right. Well, thank you to both counsel. Your answers here today have been very helpful. The matter is now submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You too.